done through audio that someone can listen to it. It's either the author or an actor. But you chose to have a woman read, voice, Don't Forget Us Here. Why?
Yeah, I remember when I was like talking to Sam from Hashtag. Hi, Sam, Antonio, and Julia, my agent. I said, guys, I need a woman. I want to read my book. No, why? It didn't happen before. You know, typically the man, I said, no, I want a woman to read my book. Monson, that doesn't make any sense. I said, what makes sense about Guantanamo? Nothing makes sense. At one plus, you know, men have been kidnapped. They tortured me, kicked my ass, imprisoned me. And like, they have done a lot of things, you know. The one who treated us, you know, nicely was woman. So I went to woman to read my book. So why not? At the same time, I told him it is like kind of racism against women. So first they sent me some kind of like men. I said, no, I want a woman to read my book. So when they found it was turned out good, they said, wow, this is a good idea. I said, no, I told you.
Former Guantanamo prisoner Mansour Adaifi, speaking from Belgrade, Serbia. He spent more than 14 years at Guantanamo, never charged. He just wrote his memoir. It's called Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo. He now works at CAGE, an organization that advocates on behalf of victims of the so-called War on Terror. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Mike Burke and Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
Bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Community radio is a democratic type of media, but what does that mean? This fall drive, KABU is examining what democracy means to each of us by featuring content focusing on picking apart democracy. To support our programs during this fall drive, go to kboo.fm and get the limited edition Sounds of Democracy shirt.
Good morning, and you are listening to KBOO here in Portland, Oregon. And this is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. Today is the 27th day of September, and I won't go into the Earth, Wind, and Fire song because there was another day in September. But we welcome you all listening to our broadcast this morning. We will have a conversation with Jason Renaud, who has been someone who's been involved in this community in many, many ways. And I knew of Jason from his work in terms of police reform and his work with what happened after the death of James Chesse, and was unfamiliar with some of his other work, which is broad and wide ranging. But Jason this morning is with us, and we'll talk about some issues around policing in Portland. What are some ideas in terms of how to transform our policing, and when we talk about community safety? And we will have the opportunity for you to call and join with us in a in conversation with Jason. But good morning, Jason. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Reverend. I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me.
Great. You know, one thing I want to mention, because I was not aware of it until I read your bio, was your work with Compassion and Choices. That was an enormously important movement in terms of compassionate care to those who are at the end of their lives. And all of this seems to be connected to what I detect is a real passion for people. Tell us about your role with Compassion and Choices and how it and your move to working more with the Mental Health Alliance.
Thank you. So I've been a mental health advocate for about 30 years, and that really comes from my own recovery from alcoholism and mental illness, and I've taken that as my recovery as a way of giving back is to help others who aren't getting help yet. And I saw the Death with Dignity movement as it grew up here in Oregon, and I was really appreciative of the work of a fellow named George Amey, who was a state legislator, a man of great courage, and steward of Oregon's LGBT community. And George was fearless in getting up and talking about how important it was to help people with legal protections and stewardship at the end of their lives as they were making choices about how they wanted to die. So I spent about a dozen years with the Death with Dignity movement, helping raise money and helping get the word out. And part of that was that I helped train doctors and nurses and other volunteers to help persons here in Oregon with the families during that dying process.
Well, one wonderful work. And what you just said at the end, that you helped train doctor and nurses to better work with those who are dying, I think it relates to what I suspect is some of your ongoing work in terms of making community aware of the issues that confront those who are those of our neighbors who are dealing with addiction and mental health issues. And can you say something more about what motivates you to reach out and to help those who, to help work with those who are often ignored or rejected by a larger society?
Oh, sure. So I'm a very fortunate person that I grew up in a strong family, and I had lots of support from them and friends, and I was able to find a way fairly quickly in my disease to get well. But I got close enough to the bottom where I got to meet a lot of people who were not going to get well, and they did not have those resources and did not have those advantages. And I thought, you know, I don't know how it is that I was born in this place, but I feel I now have a little bit of an obligation to continue to help these brothers and sisters that are of mine, these sisters and brothers through this disease of alcoholism and mental illness, to do what I can as an individual to help those people ease their suffering in some way. And some of those people, that might be abstinence, and some of those people, it might be housing, and some of those people, it might be just guidance, you know, where's the next sanctuary. But these are very hard conversations, and I'm interested in where others are unwilling to talk about basic important issues of life.
And they are hard conversations. And I think maybe because we don't know what to say or how to say or you know, don't know where to start. And I think we realize this, many of us, in terms of seeing how our law enforcement agencies and individuals are often commissioned or charged with dealing with those who are dealing with some of the issues you raised up. And I think part of the work you do is continuing your education in terms of how do we have not only these hard conversations, but what are effective and transformative ways in which we work with all people in our society. So how do, let's go into what I will hope will be a major part of our conversation is in terms of policing. And we all are aware of the results of the pandemic we are in. We are aware of how people are impacted, increased number of people who are houseless, and an inability for our society, I think, to treat, to work effectively in transforming our work. What do you think are some of the things that law enforcement officials are challenged with these days? And tell us something about your work in terms of looking at policing and how we may think of policing in a different way.
Sure. So our organization is the Mental Health Association of Portland. And early on in our work, we did some strategic planning, and we came to a realization that there were three institutions in Oregon that were very dangerous to people with mental illness. And those three are the Oregon State Hospital. Mm-hmm. And this is in the late 1990s, so a lot of things have changed at the hospital, and in part because of our advocacy. The second organization is the Multnomah County Jail, which remains quite a dangerous place because it is the largest psychiatric facility in the state. And the third would be the Portland Police Bureau. And we found over and over that there would be little stories in the newspaper where someone had been harmed by the police, and it would be just a little, like, naked man in Safeway parking lot beaten by police. And we know that's one of our people. That's not just a regular guy who clothes magically disappeared and the police were decided to beat him up. No, that's a person who is has untreated addiction or untreated mental illness and has fallen through all the safety nets. And the police are the backstop of our social society, so fallen into their hands and into their abuse. And we found that there were a lot of these little news stories, and we decided we would follow one. And then we followed another and another. And we found, going back to about 1970, that there's been about 122 people killed by Portland police. And we think that almost all of them were impaired in some sense or another, maybe as many as 80%. And this is a lot of work, looking at the public record, at newspapers, both, you know, those that are published now and those were published in the past, and talking with family members and survivors to get this database put together. Eventually, we decided we wanted to follow one case from the very beginning to the very end, from the beginning of a person's life to when the legal and maybe social impact was over. And that was, we looked very hard for that person because we knew that to capture the public's attention, that person needed to be of a certain character. We needed to have a certain level of innocence about them. And we did eventually select a guy named James Chastey. And we were able to work get to know his family and get to know you know, what who he was as a person, meet a lot of his friends, and make a documentary film about both his life and his death. We think that that was quite a catalyst for the creation of the federal lawsuit against the city of Portland, which is really the only form of police reform we've had here for about a decade. And that case is called United States versus City of Portland.
We're speaking this morning with Jason Renaud, who is, I want to get your title correct. Is it, are you the director, executive director, Jason?
No, I'm just a board member.
Board member, okay. Board member with the Mental Health Alliance, is that the correct title?
The Mental Health Association of Portland is the organization, and the Mental Health Alliance is the program that is involved with this particular court case, United States versus City of Portland.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jason. And in a few minutes, not quite now, we'll invite people to call in with questions and comments for Jason. I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm here with Celeste Carey, and we're having some challenges with the microphone. So, Celeste, when you are ready, when things are working, we invite you to join our conversation. Are you there, Jay? Not yet.
No, I think I'm finally here.
Okay,
yes.
Great.
Okay.
So Jason, tell us a little bit about the, well, we know something about the James Chassie case, and just recently we discovered that the grand jury declined to indict a member for the killing of Robert Delgado in Lentz Park, which for me it seems like, oh no, here we are again and again. Of those three institutions you mentioned, the Oregon State Hospital, Multnomah City County Jail, and the Portland Police Bureau, which agency is currently most difficult to work with or to make transformation possible?
Well, we're working almost entirely with the police bureau at this point. We did work with the hospital for many years, and of course the hospital was torn down to the foundation and rebuilt. And there's still plenty of problems there, but there's other organizations which have taken up that fight and are doing well. The Multnomah County Jail right now is fairly well managed as an old fashioned jail can be. We'll be looking in the next decade at how to, in Multnomah County, how to build a new jail which acknowledges that mental illness and addiction is a major function of the jail, to provide some clinical services, some detox services. That conversation hasn't started yet. We'll get involved in that. But that'll be a future sheriff and a future county commission that has that discussion. Mm-hmm. So right now our focus is mostly on the Portland police, but it's really coming to a conclusion, because the aspects around police reform that have to do with mental illness have all basically been sunk by the court and discharged by both the parties, the city and the DOJ. They're not going to do anything about issues about mental illness.
Now, are you participating in the Portland Committee for Community Engaged Policing?
Well, when the PSEP began, the persons with mental illness who were assigned to the PSEP by the mayor talked with me about forming a subcommittee for people with mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And I did facilitate that subcommittee for about 18 months. That subcommittee made several recommendations to the PSEP, which were all dismissed out of hand. And the group felt that the PSEP was not not really taking them seriously. And so that group did resign en masse.
That whole group?
In court. Yeah.
Are they not existing now?
2020.
So you're saying they're not
existing? The new group is a completely different group that had nothing to do with the prior group.
Are you sure about
that? There is a group. Oh, yes.
Well, the reason I ask is because I'm not on the mental health committee, but I know there is a committee that is actively engaged in advocating, I mean seriously advocating, for mental health reforms. And some of the people who are involved are people who are living with mental health challenges.
Right. That's a second subcommittee that formed after the first subcommittee resigned.
Uh-huh. So, have you approached that subcommittee?
There's people in the Mental Health Alliance who attend all of those meetings.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, some of the recommendations you mentioned that were just shut down, what were they, and how would they have affected brought about both reform and better treatment for people with mental health challenges that have been arrested?
Well, in the first weeks and months of the PSEP, actually the majority of PSEP members objected to the subcommittee for people with mental illness being formed. They felt that was not a subject that was necessary for the PSEP to talk about as a unique subcommittee.
Uh-huh.
So we felt that there was really going to have a hard time bringing forward a recommendation that was specific about mental illness.
Now, are you aware that the U.S. Department of Justice attorney, Jared Hager, he said that was the actual principal action that caused the city to be subjected to that settlement, was the fact that it was mental health challenges and the treatment that Portland police had, you know, subjected people to that was the centerpiece of the whole settlement.
Well, he's exactly right. And so it was very frustrating when the initial members of the PSEP rejected these recommendations. So the group made a recommendation they thought would be very simple for the PSEP to accept, just in the exercise of having a recommendation accepted and then forwarded for implementation. So they thought that the police chief should write a letter of condolence to the families of persons who were killed by police action.
Yes.
And that was rejected, I think, twice.
Now, to my knowledge, it's supposed to be implemented now, but you're right, it still is struggling to be actualized.
Right. Well, this is 2020, and that's quite a long time ago, and that was 2019, actually, and that was rejected. It's been revived since then, and I think Mayor Wheeler is struggling to get his words right, but he did write something like a letter to both the Townsend family and the Delgado family. We've already contacted the mayor's office to help him write that a little bit better, future letters.
That's good because, you know, we do need a lot of not only community involvement but agency involvement to bring about a lot of the changes that are needed. So I do appreciate your work. You are listening to More Talk Radio, and Cecil, you are here, I am here, and our guest, and James, I'm sorry, I forgot your last name.
Jason
Renault, there we go. Is here with the Mental Health Alliance. Okay, Cecil, I think you jinxed me. I want to say Mental Health Alliance, but it's not that, is it, Jason?
We're with the Mental Health Association.
Association, thank you.
The Alliance is a program of our organization, along with Disability Rights Oregon, the Portland Interfaith Clergy Resistance, and the Oregon Justice Resource Center.
Now, you were one of the partners in the amicus brief, correct?
That's right.
Yes. Can you tell us a little bit how you got involved? And you've spoken, you know, about some of the frustrations you've had with moving things forward. But for a lot of people, they may not understand, you know, the nuts and bolts of how you got involved and why this particular settlement is so important, not just to Portland, but to the nation as well.
Well, it is an interesting case, and it is important. There are many consent decrees around the country which attempt to reform various parts of various police bureaus. But this one is the only one where the findings, and this was somewhat surprising, and we should talk about it, but the findings were not about race. They mm-hmm. were about a pattern and practice of harming people with mental illness. And we can debate about how that happened. I don't think there's any clear answer. But probably the reason that happened is that the 10 files that the DOJ looked at were all people who were white, but that may have been a circumstance of the demographics of the city of Portland and not a very good indicator of the institutional racism within the bureau. So that's work yet to be done, I think, and work that was kind of and very frustratingly stalled in order to go into this lawsuit and focus all this attention. But that's the findings, that they found a pattern of practice of harm against people with mental illness. But the settlement agreement itself has almost nothing to do with mental illness and almost entirely things to do with reforming basic police practices, things that the police department should be able to do on itself, like provide training, be accountable, have engagement with the community. So those have had to go through the court and had to go through a legal process. And that's in part because the Bureau was a little bit stuck in itself, but also because the political people in the mayor's office and in the HR, Human Resources Department of the city, had been stalled in getting their goals met in collective bargaining with the police union. So this is a workaround to get those collective bargaining issues back on the table.
And what are some of those collective bargaining issues?
Well, there are things like how do we do training? Mm-hmm. How do we do community engagement? And how do we make ourselves accountable to the citizens of the city? Now, there's 187 items mm-hmm. in this settlement agreement, and almost all of them have either been complied with, they're finished, they're done. We've been doing this for 9 years now, so mm-hmm. a lot of them are done. So there are a few that are undone, which both parties, both the city and the DOJ, have agreed not to do. And those are the pieces around helping people with mental illness. And then now, just in the last couple of months, there are some new items that are being added. And these are added by the federal government, the Department of Justice, to help the City of Portland's Police Bureau repair what happened in the summer of 2020 in the protests. And they're all directly associated with the protest issues. And there are 9 of those proposed by the feds, and one has been proposed by the federal judge. Mm-hmm. And we're now in mediation about those 10 items. And I think 7 of those 10, or maybe... Yeah, 7 of those 10 have been agreed upon. So we're getting close to the end here. And once these items are agreed upon, that these will be re-included with the settlement agreement, then the police will start to work on them, and the DOJ will monitor the agreement, or perhaps a court monitor will be assigned to take over the monitoring of the case from the DOJ. Once those items are complied with, then they have to stay in compliance for a full year. And if they're in compliance for that full year, then the case will be closed.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your community connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area. If you are in Philomath, Oregon, Point South in the Willamette Valley, 104.3, 91.9 in all points east along the Columbia River Gorge in Hood River, and of course on the web, www.kboo.fm. I am here with my co-host Cecil. I am Celeste, and we're speaking with Jason Renaud. And is it about that time to open the phone, Cecil?
Yes, I believe we have a caller.
Jeremy,
good morning.
Hi. I'm sorry, I missed the first 15 or 20 minutes, and I'm wondering if you've already covered this. Why has the pilot program to copy what's going on in Eugene, the CAHOOTS program, where, mm-hmm. you know, starting to replace cops with teams of you know, less intrusive, less invasive, less violent,
yes.
people to respond to people experiencing emotional issues. Why is that sort of stalled? I mean, I think you have, you know, a couple of people in Lent, and that's it. And it's been several years. Is this all wound up with the collective bargaining? But I mean, you know, the Portland Police Bureau has an open Nazi worshiper as a captain. You know, they have no capacity to, and no interest in disciplining themselves, as can be seen by their violation of every civil liberty known to an American all summer long.
Well, let's get Jason to respond to your inquiry.
Well, Portland does have Portland Street Response is gotten started. These projects are getting started. These alternatives to police are getting started all over the country. Every major city is looking at some form of this, and many are looking at Eugene as a model. And certainly Portland did. And some of them are being embedded. Now, CAHOOTS is a private nonprofit organization. The Portland Street Response is embedded in the fire department, but so is San Francisco's mobile crisis service system, and they're doing great. These take a long time to build up, to scale up. They're hard to hire for. I mean, the people who do this sort of work are hard to find, hard to support. They need to be integrated into emergency services and 911 and into outpatient health care and other social services. They're tough to grow. So I'm confident. I really appreciate the person that they hired for Portland Street Response. She's great. She's going to do great. We do need to increase the size. We need to give them all the resources they can have to grow, but growing these is going to be slow. Now, but Portland Street Response is just one part of mobile services for Portland. We have literally, I would guess, 25 different
yes.
parts and pieces of government and nonprofit agencies that do mobile outreach of some sort or another. The worrisome thing is that they're all somewhat disconnected from each other and
mm-hmm.
unaware
yes.
of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So well, to a degree, yeah,
several
you're right.
Several are with the Portland Police Bureau. Several are with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. The district attorney has one. Cascadia has one. Central City Concern has one. Transition Project has one.
Join has one. I used to sit on their committee, yeah.
They do great work in the homeless pods and out on the Springwater Corridor and mm-hmm. just reaching people who are unreached by other agencies. But that's the next step, is to sort of get these connected to each other, get these all working together rather than independently operating. So Jeremy, I think we have a lot of promise. This is inevitable. The police are understanding that this is not a replacement for police. It's an alternative to police. And this is not work they want to do. So they're going to there's still some truculent recalcitrant characters, but I think we'll get there fairly soon.
Well, it seems as if, you know, you began to enumerate the number of different sections that have these active outreach teams, and they're all somewhat disconnected and independent of one another. So it seems as if it's quite a challenge to weave them together to be able to maybe work together to coordinate their actions, and it's ongoing. And
well, there are occasional groups that do get together. Back in the day, I sat on kind of like a inter-bureau or inter-agency task force But you're right, and in the age of COVID, it's got worse.
Yeah, COVID has been a big setback in all things mental health. We had a lot of agencies not be able to provide the services that were needed, and people continued to fall through those safety nets, ending up homeless or in jail or much sicker than they needed to be.
Our phone number is 503-231-8187. And we're speaking with Jason Renault, and we are talking about reforms necessary, not just in Portland Police, but, you know, in interagency service, joint service for mental health and people with addictions. We welcome your call. You were talking about some of the challenges earlier that had, you know, been knocked aside. And the one you brought up, rather a caller brought up and you expanded on, was the project that does bring people who are trained in mental health response, mental health service. Is there anything else that you see coming down the pike that's an improvement? Or if there isn't, what is your next challenge?
Well, I think that we've actually cut some things recently, in recent years, that would have been very helpful. We, for example, the contract the city had for years and years with Central City Concern to provide detoxification services for people who are acutely ill with alcoholism or heroin addiction, that was closed in February of 2020, and isn't, there's no timeline to have that reopened. It's now, the city isn't even working on it anymore. The now an organization called HealthShare is now leading that revamping of detox. We also closed a lot of our open doors for people in psychiatric emergencies. Now there's only one door, and that's at Legacy's psychiatric emergency hospital called Unity. So that's very difficult, especially for people who are can't transport themselves while in crisis. And then we've limited. It's been because there's so little has been so little money for mental health and addiction care. Really, at the salaries of the entry level workers has really not gone up in years and years. The workforce has really been damaged. If you're a young person and you want to help people who are homeless or people with mental illness, and you look at the salary level, you could be making twice as much money as the post office pretty quick. So that we've lost a lot of folks just because we're not able to pay them a reasonable living wage. And that's made it very difficult to sustain effective addiction and mental health treatment really across the state. Now that's changed just, or is changing just in the last year, but the damage has been done over a couple of decades. So it's going to take us a long time to build that workforce back.
We're speaking this morning with Jason Renault of the Mental Health Alliance of Portland. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. And let's go to our next caller, Martin, I believe.
Good morning.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, we can.
According to a article in the Willamette Week, this current issue of Willamette Week, the city council this fall will vote on an increase for Portland Street Response. And I think the last time they voted on it, they voted it down. But it would be nice maybe if people would call the city council members and say, this is a good thing, and please vote for Portland Street, the increase in funding for Portland Street Response.
Great.
Okay. Now, are either of you aware of the subcommittee that's working on the core patrol services?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Do you imagine that as a helpful response to what our caller Martin has mentioned, and then some of the other challenges you've mentioned about not only service collaboration, but getting the city and police to have a more secure buy-in on a relevant and therapeutic mental health response.
Well, I think Commissioner Hardesty's proposal is modest in comparison to other cities, mm-hmm. and has unfortunately been politicized in our city hall. So it's going a little slower than everyone would want it to. But I'm optimistic about this next vote that Martin brings up, and I do encourage people to contact their city councilors, especially the commissioners that might not vote, may have voted in opposition to Portland Street Response in the last time it was available. The dilemma with the PSEP's core services recommendation is that nobody knows about them, mm-hmm. Because the city has done a poor job at staffing that committee, that there's really very little participation by the community in the committee that's supposed to engage the community with the police. And so we're sort of waiting for some help there, which I don't foresee happening anytime soon.
So when you say not enough staff, what do you mean?
Well, these meetings are often attended by more City of Portland staff people and police officers than by members of the community. Mm-hmm. So it's hard. They're having a hard time getting the word out and getting the community to actually participate with the meeting.
Now, I know that they have it publicized on not only the city webpage but on Facebook, and I've seen some of them pretty fully attended. So, in terms of getting the word out,
We do attend them all. We do keep a track of.
So I was about to say, so in terms of getting the word out, have you found that the mental health agencies are promoting the word to their constituents, as advocates?
No.
Or is there a participation from the agencies themselves?
We've made recommendations to the PSEP and the PSEP staff and even to the Department of Justice that mm-hmm. there be some community outreach done, but those have been rejected.
So let me ask, as a totally outsider here, in terms of getting people involved in these meetings, it seems to me a challenge. I would have some hesitancy to enter into a gathering, whether virtual or in physical, of what I would assume is a bunch of insiders, and I would suspect an inability for them to hear, to create a space enough that's receptive for me to take part in those conversations. How might these gatherings be, how might they be more effective in getting community involvement and hearing the voices of those we need to hear and not just those who are insiders?
Well, Cecil, I think you're exactly right. This is very difficult for people to walk in the door and know what's going on, and it does feel like you've entered midstream in a long, complex discussion. I think that's incumbent on the hosts of any committee, and I think there's many committees that suffer from this, to be able to provide that introduction and that welcoming, or example, provide training for these members of these committees so that they know all this, what's gone on before.
Now, I know that there is training offered. So my question would be, how connected agencies are to PSEP, and do they feel comfortable engaging? Because I know that there are people on these committees, like I said, who are part of other organizations and have been working hard to engage more members of the community. And some of them are mental health practitioners, and some of them are advocates. So what do you see as another step that can be taken to get the word out. Because like I said, I know it's on Facebook. I know that you can see the meetings on YouTube, and that you will see some of them that are well attended. And I know that at some of the overall steering committee meetings, there is a lot of public involvement. And again, some of them are people who are mental health care recipients as well as mental health care practitioners.
So the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Peace and Justice Reform and the Mental Health Alliance worked together over the past 18 months to fashion a set of performance measures for the PSEP. And this was asked for by Judge Michael Simon in the case, in the status hearing in 2019. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those performance measures had to do with, are you in contact with agencies around the city? Are you inviting people? Do you have a training curriculum? Are you doing exit interviews with PSEP members? Is there a recruitment plan? And we presented this to the parties in the case and to the PSEP many times. And it has actually been voted on by the PSEP, and they actually voted to not vote on it. So the PSEP didn't accept these outside recommendations, and they didn't create any for themselves about doing community outreach.
Well, that's not wholly true. I mean, I've seen some of the recruitment process. Now, it may not be as robust as you want, are you talking about 2019? Because this is 2021.
Well, this discussion began in 2019.
Right, but
as of today, the PSEP has not accepted any specific performance outcomes, whether they're created by outsiders or
actually
insiders.
They're working on metrics now. So
yes, I know. I wrote half of them.
Okay. I got thought I had a high sign for a call. Okay, so the ones you've written, are they being currently reviewed, because they are looking at metrics now, both in terms of measuring outreach, working with past PSEP members to improve the process and streamlining the recruitment process?
Those all sound great. It's just putting them... Just agreeing to do them is the question.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the challenge. I think generally when you look at institutions and the way in which they change or are enable to get feedback from those outside, it's an ongoing challenge where you have institutions who by their very nature want to protect and preserve who and how they are and how open they are to transformation. It becomes a challenge. And I admire those who work on the inside and also those who put pressure on the outside. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. We're speaking with Jason Renaud of the Mental Health Association. And we invite your calls if you have a question or comment. And let's go. Do we have a caller yet? No, not quite yet. But we will in a second. Again, you're listening to KBOO, More Talk Radio. I am Cecil. I'm here with Celeste and here with community activist Jason Renaud. Let's go to Michael right now. Good morning, Michael. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thank you for your program. I tuned in late, and I do understand that you're talking about mental health and PSEF and the Portland Clean Energy Fund. Am I correct?
No.
Not the Clean Energy Fund. Not today.
No.
Ah, okay. Then what is PSEF then? I'm sorry.
It's the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing. It grew out of the Department of Justice settlement against the City of Portland and Portland Police for police mishandling, mistreatment of people with mental health and addictions.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you for the clarification.
All right.
Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, that's all right. Thank you for your call.
No interruption at all. Jason, what are the things that you are hopeful for in the next 5 years in terms of transformation of how our institutions deal with those who are experiencing mental health challenges and addictions?
Well, I'm so glad you asked because this is important to me. I'm so encouraged by the political activism of the past year or so, and the injection of millions of young people into these conversations. They bring a whole different energy and acceptance and unwillingness to just accept the status quo in the world of mental health. And more of those every day are people of color. And we have a great issue here where we really are moving people with mental illness and untreated addiction very rapidly into the criminal justice system, where they can stay stuck for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And that's a reflection of health inequity that has been here in Oregon and here in Portland for my whole life. We desperately need culturally competent service providers and culturally competent agencies to provide direct services to especially young people of color who have these issues and want help. And I'm really hopeful that in the next 5 years, HealthShare and Multnomah County and the state of Oregon support the services that are available, support the persons who are working on these services to make them more available and grow these services so that we can sort of help anybody who we can to not end up sick, homeless, in jail, or in prison.
Now, you mentioned something that is near and dear to my heart, and that is culturally competent services. And I know that Oregon Health Sciences is the base for the Avell Gordley Center for Healing. Is this one of the organizations that you've been working with in terms of helping expand your vision?
Well, yes, and Avell has had this vision for years and years, and she is personally tied to this in ways that are. She's been a great advocate and fully supportive of the Avell Gordley Center. There's also the, but it's Avell Gordley is very small.
It's small, but it has a really robust for its size program, you know, that works with folks of color and has like programs for survivors of domestic violence as well as addiction services and mental health services. And you're right, it could be bigger.
Yeah, so the other place that really I'm excited about that's grown quite a bit over the last few years has new a great executive director is the Miracles Club on Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
It's just very hard. I'm a white, heterosexual, middle-aged male, and you know I want to help, but I'm not the right person for everyone.
Don't say that, Jason. That's not true. You are an advocate. You have a voice that speaks out in support, and you're the kind of person who can bring funding and awareness in ways a lot of people can't. You know, I used to work a lot with the Miracles Club and helping them with some issues, and it's a lot of the white partners and allies that help us get over some of the resistance, you know, cultural confusion and all that. So you make a difference.
Well, I want to make a difference, and thank you for that. But sometimes a person needs to talk to someone who they're comfortable with.
That's
without,
true.
And I want to make sure that that person is available, especially for people who are in crisis.
Mm-hmm.
It's so important, and that's something that our community could invest in. So to reduce crisis, and then that in turn reduces the need for police. And that's the big picture here, is we need to reduce the need for police by providing these services long before the crisis occurs.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that I find fascinating is we talk a lot about certain crime trends going down. Now, and I'm talking primarily immediately pre-COVID and maybe in the first, you know, months of COVID, certain crimes were down. But I don't think people recognize or are addressing the fact that with regard to mental health, it seems like interactions with mental health, people with mental health challenges and the police seem to be going up. And I think it's really important for us to pay attention to that shift, like you say, and, you know, reconfigure how we do public safety. And I say that as somebody who worked in public safety, you know, for 18, 19 years. So what can we do right now, Jason, to really get that momentum going, to keep it in the front of our city legislators, to keep our agencies excited about looking at new ways to collaborate?
Well, I think that's right. What we need, that's what we need to do. And if we want to reduce our need dependence on police, we need to provide those services in the field. And some of them have to start when a person is very young, maybe years and years before that crisis occurs. And sometimes when, you know, we talked about let's defund the police. Well, the alternative to that is let's refund the services that have been cut over years and years,
mm-hmm.
and rebuild that workforce with young people, with people of color, with people who look like and feel like those who are coming in the door. We need to provide services for people whose first language is Russian, mm-hmm. as well as Spanish. We need to provide services in the middle of the night. We need to provide services for people who might not conform to our ideals in the criminal justice arena. You know, they may have, they may be on paper and be involved in the criminal justice system, and we still need to provide services for them.
Yes.
We're just sort of learning how to do this, and it's kind of amazing to me that the learning has gone on for a long time.
Yeah. So I want to encourage people to do something that Jason had mentioned, and that is take a look at the website and perhaps even be involved in the Portland Committee for Community Engaged Policing. Because I did hear you say something that's very important, is that we need more community engagement. We need more people to study the documents so they can come in and have an informed contribution, because we need more people to advocate for mental health changes within Portland Police Bureau. Any final words?
Just your listeners out there, if they would like to know more about these subjects, to have that background conversation, Cecil was thinking about an introduction to these issues and how to get involved in an effective way, come to our website, mentalhealthportland.org, click on the email link, and we'll get in contact with you.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Thank you
and
so much.
If you will, I will, is your contact information on your website?
You bet.
Oh, good. I'd love to talk to you more and see how we can collaborate.
We should.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Jason, and thank you for your good work.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you for having me on KBOO.
And you have been listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO. We had one caller who was not able to get on air, and this is related to the conversations we had in terms of policing and how we deal with members of our society. Today is the last day before the city re-signs its contract with the Clean and Safe, the controversial downtown Portland Clean and Safe, which beefs up sanitation and security. It continues to be a controversial decision by city council, and so Edie, I imagine, would want you to call your city commissioners to weigh in on that. Thank you so much for being a part of our program this morning. Stay tuned for more programming. Next up is the OMO Variety Hour.
And be sure to join KBOO and become a member. Go to kboo.fm, click join support. This is your community connection. KBOO 90.7 Portland.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Democracy is an experiment, and so is community radio. During this fall membership drive, KBOO will take a deep dive into democracy in all its forms, from current events.